Welcome to the Kelly Cardenas Podcast, where attitude is everything. On today's show, I am so honored to have this young man on. He's the president of one of the premier, I think the premier company in the professional beauty industry, and if not throughout the world, setting an example of culture and what truly matters, which is the people behind what is going on and what is going with their product. But I am so excited to be able to have him on, not just because he's the president of that company, the president of John Paul Mitchell Systems, but also because this man's heart is bigger than he is. And he doesn't know this, that I was going to even talk about this part of it. But I had the opportunity, probably the opportunity of a lifetime. And I called and I needed a little bit of a push to be able to get over the hump in this deal that I was doing with the Hard Rock Casino in Las Vegas. And there wasn't even a question asked. There wasn't a video sent. There wasn't a call that was made. There was actually a young man that got on a plane and flew out to Las Vegas for about 45 minutes to sit in a meeting and to be able to help somebody to be able to get what they wanted. And I think that it's so incredible to be able to see human beings that are able to do this. And not only that, but a human being who's leading one of the greatest companies in the entire world. Thank you for being on the show, Mr. Jason Yates.
Thank you, Kelly. Man, I'd forgotten about that until you just brought it up. So, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that was great. It was good. I think it was the first time we really ever spent any time together. Yeah.
Well, it was amazing, man. I mean, you do this for people, and it's like, you know, generally you see a president of the company, right? And, you know, especially a company like you guys, you know, this is a multi-billion dollar company. For those of you who don't know who Paul Mitchell is, let me welcome you to Earth. So, I mean, the president of a company that's so vast and so large, but yet when you walk into the headquarters, you're literally walking down the hall saying hello to, it's almost like family members, friends. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is the magic in the culture itself?
Yeah. I mean, I know exactly what you mean, because that's how I felt the day I had my interview and I walked through the doors. It's just a special aura when you walk into the place. It just permeates throughout the whole building. I think it starts with John Paul, to be honest. I think it starts with John Paul DeJuria, the founder of John Paul Mitchell Systems. I didn't have the pleasure to know Paul Mitchell, the co-founder. He obviously passed away quite a while ago. But I do know Angus Mitchell, his son, and who is the joint owner with John Paul today. And I got to tell you, I think the culture starts with those guys. It starts from the top in the way that they behave and present themselves, and it just comes through the whole organization.
This episode is brought to you by one of my favorite companies in the entire world, the Mina Group. As one of the top culinary experiences in the world, celebrity chef Michael Mina and his team are dedicated to giving you what you never knew you always wanted. With 30 locations throughout the world, this company is focused on the one thing that truly matters, their people, and that is why they are your world of wow. Change your life by going to michaelmina.net. So a question that I've wanted to ask is probably not a question you get asked a lot, but okay, John Paul Mitchell Systems, I've been with them for 29 years. I've been around the block, watched things, and here comes in 2012. This young dude from another company comes rolling up in, and this generally doesn't work out well, man. I mean, when you have a family of people and then you have someone new come in and you're a good looking guy, like, let me just tell you that, like, if you're not watching, if you're just listening, you could tell by his voice he's good looking anyway, but you're a really, really good looking guy. You're super young at the time. You're really old now. I'm just joking with you. We were talking about that earlier, but I'm saying you're a super young dude. Here you come. You're this great looking guy. You come in 2012 when, I mean, this company is already rolling, man. And here comes this dude, and I remember it.
Yeah.
And most of the time when that stuff happens, people are like, why are you trying to jump on? Who are you? You ain't been around here. You don't know nothing, all this stuff. But it was amazing because you not only became a part of it, like you came in and you continued to add to it. You started off in marketing, went to sales and marketing, went to the COO, and now are the president. But you've done it so gracefully along the way. Tell us about that transition and how you were able to enter a company that was already functioning at a high level. And you came from a competitor. How were you able to do that, Jason?
Yeah. It sounds quite hard, but I've got to say, it's just over 9 years. What you just described happened in 9 years. And first of all, I was hired by John Paul Mitchell Systems. That they came calling me, which was a huge compliment. I was working for a competitor. And at the time, the president, Luke Jacob Ellis, who anybody that doesn't know Luke is a great guy, great mentor. You've got to get him on the podcast. He's fantastic. Very wise man. And much older than me. Sorry, Luke. But no, I digress. So I was working for a competitor. It was also a fairly large company. I held the title of VP of Sales and Marketing. And I got a call from a guy, you might not know him, Kelly. His name is John Gallier. He's the president, or was the president, of BSG, the largest distributor in North America, who distributes John Paul Mitchell Systems products, also distributes many other brands. And John called me and said, "You're a cool dude. We really like you. You've done wonders for our relationship with the company you work for now. However, I like to put great people at great companies. And right now, you're at an okay company, and there's a great company that could really use a guy like you. Would you mind talking to John Paul Mitchell Systems?" Because Luke had told John that he was looking for somebody in marketing. So that's kind of how the door opened. And it started with a phone call that I had with Luke and Michaeline DeJoria. Michaeline is the new CEO, who's John Paul's daughter, and she's terrific as well. Another great guest for the show, if you haven't had her on yet. And I had a phone call, and it just felt easy. It was very natural. I was just myself. I wasn't looking for a job. I was happy. I of course knew who Paul Mitchell was and had tons of respect for them. And kind of when you're not on the inside of Paul Mitchell and you're looking from the outside, you're like, what is it about that company? I mean, they have good products, but so do we. But there's like this cultish type following, and like, what's going on in there? But after the conversation with Luke and Michaeline, I just couldn't stop smiling. And my wife, who had encouraged me, my new wife, actually, I got married in May 2012, and I got the call in May 2012 on my honeymoon that Paul Mitchell were interested. So timing is very important here, because my wife is the one that encouraged me to like do the phone call and go to the interview, because I'm a pretty loyal guy. I've been in the industry since 1990. I'm my hairdresser, so I think you know that, Kelly. I worked behind the chair from 1990 to 2002. I joined Farouk Systems at 2002 as the artistic director, worked my way up to VP of Sales and Marketing by 2012. And I was pretty happy. I was punching way above my weight. I thought, I'm just a hairdresser. I'm just a normal guy that put his head down, worked hard, tried to do the right thing, and just good things happened to me. When this opportunity came, my wife encouraged me to go for it. And I flew out to LA, met what felt like the entire company. But when I walked through the doors, you just kind of described it at the top of the podcast. I just felt, I believe in the big guy, of course, up there. And I just felt something was telling me like, this feels right. It feels good. And I want to say it's the weirdest interview, because I only ever had like one interview in 30 years. So this is, I guess, my second interview. Maybe all interviews are like this at John Paul Mitchell Systems, but I got interviewed by everybody in a leadership position in the company. That says a lot about the company, because we don't just hire for resume. We don't just hire for, how talented somebody is. They've got to fit culturally and have the right heart and just gel with the company. And I got interviewed all day long, and it culminated with being interviewed by JP, and he gave me a glass of wine on the interview. I didn't know if it was a trick, like, am I supposed to drink this or not? So, I was myself the whole time, and I was just myself. He asked me a few questions that I didn't know the answer to. And I said, JP, I don't know the answer to that, but I don't want to give you bad information. So anyway, at the end of the interview, JP said, "I like you, young man. And Thanks for not answering the question because you didn't know. He said a lot of people would have given me a, you know, a bullshit answer. You told me you didn't know, and that's good. Anyway, good luck. And then Luke comes in and offers me the job on the spot, which I was shocked. I said, let me talk to my wife because we lived in Texas. The job was obviously in LA. So I flew home, talked to my wife, and she said, you haven't stopped smiling since you got through the door. She said, I prayed about this last night. She said, I think it's the right thing to do. And I said, well, how are we going to do this? We have a son, you know, we're going to move across the country. She said, go for it. Let's just do it. We'll figure it out. My wife's a flight attendant, so like it's easy for her to move around. So yeah, we just, we up and left. I had my interview in the beginning of June. I gave my 2 weeks notice. That didn't go down well, that I was moving to go to Paul Mitchell. But I did my 2 weeks notice, finished on the Friday. They made me work the full 2 weeks notice. I got in my car and drove from Houston, Texas to LA. Got there Sunday night, started at Paul Mitchell on Monday morning 9 years ago. So, and a lot of other things have happened since, but that's how I got going. As far as to continue to answer your question, like how does a guy like me fit in? I would say what I've learned from my time in corporate America and my time working in behind the chair and managing salons and is whenever you go into a new situation, the worst thing you can do is try and stamp your authority on things right away or try and change things. I was just a sponge. I just was nice. I tried to get to know people on a personal level and asked them a bunch of questions and learned and absorbed along the way and just try and not be an asshole, try and be humble. And you know, there was a lot I needed to learn. And listen, Paul Mitchell's a successful company. They're doing a lot of things right. I didn't want to assume that there was anything they were doing that they could do better. I just looked for opportunities where I thought I could add value and I saw a few quick wins and that's all I looked for, just small victories, quick wins. And when we had them, we celebrated them as a team. And I think that helped people take to me pretty quick. And I just think because I'm a hairdresser, my whole career, I think a lot of my success, especially on the corporate side, it's because I'm a hairdresser. I don't forget who we are and who our customers are, you know, so.
Another pause for station identification and shameless promotion. This episode is also brought to you by Finley Cars of Las Vegas. I tell you, next level in the car buying experience. And not only that, but the life of your car, the service that you're going to experience is incredible. It's Finley Volvo Cars, LV.com. And also brought to you by Bling Shine Serum, the only product on the market that will add weightless moisture, strength, and shine, and the only product that has the endorsement of my mama. When I showed her all the features and benefits, she smelled it and she said, this is the greatest product that you've ever done. And I thought, Mom, do you not look at the features and benefits? She said, no, if it smells like that, it must work. And I tell you, every single woman needs a little bit of bling in their life, and this can be purchased at KellyCardenasSalon.com. So you talked about, I want to dive into a little something that you said, and you went through it quick. But you said that you had a couple of, you know, you saw a couple of opportunities, small ones, and you utilized them and then you celebrated them. Talk to us about some of those first little opportunities, because no one's arguing that it was a great company before you came, but no one in the world, there's no one in the world that could argue with the progress that I've seen in the last 9 years since you've been there. And I mean, and when I say that, it's impacted my life, my family, my dad, my mom, my brother. Your leadership has impacted that on, I mean, and I'm not talking about like I hear about it. I'm saying I've actually felt it. I've seen it not only in my heart and around, but I've seen it in my, like, fall to the bottom line in my businesses and to my pocketbook personally. But can you tell us about some of those little opportunities that you saw right off the bat?
Sure. So an initial one, I came from a company that was very strong in hair care appliances. I mean, that was what they led in. And I saw a wonderful company in Paul Mitchell that had a huge following of hairdressers that were very loyal, loved them, loved every product that they made. But we weren't really plain in the appliance space at all. So to me, I saw right away, the reason we weren't playing there is we didn't really have any expertise in that area. And I had a lot of expertise in that area. So, you know, I pointed out the opportunity. I got the full support of Luke. And I said, I think there's no reason why we can't own the appliance business like we own the liquid business. You know, I mean, we have a great network. We have a great brand. You know, I have good connections. I can make us great appliances. Let's look at that as an opportunity. And, you know, every time a guest sits in a chair, they're going to buy a blow dryer and buy an iron if it's being used by a professional, if it's being professionally recommended. And we didn't really have a whole lot going on in that. You know, to me, I saw that we were a hair care company that had appliances. We weren't an appliance company, and I wanted us to be an authority in that. So that was one of those quick victories. Quite quickly, we developed the Neuro brand. We wanted to have a point of difference, got that to market, and then we celebrated it as a team. And many people on the team's careers grew because of that. Financially, they were compensated because of that. I think salons enjoyed that too. So that was like a quick win on the product side. If I look at, you know, process side and how people interact with each other, I felt like when I first joined, you know, the other department heads, there was a lot of finger pointing, you know, which happens a lot in organizations where, you know, often the sales team blames the marketing team blames the sales team, everybody blames education if something goes wrong. So I really tried to work on building my relationships with them, but building our relationships together. And, you know, we made some good progress. It took a while, and, you know, it's really, really important you have the right people in the right places. And we also switched a lot of people around. So I think what we had at John Paul Mitchell Systems was classic of an entrepreneurial company that grew fast and had a very loyal base of people. We kept people for a long time and ended up doing jobs that perhaps they weren't ready to do, but they did them anyway. So that's not necessarily a bad thing, but if you can bring in a little bit of support or expertise or move them to where they can get, you can get the best out of them, I think at the end of the day, they're happier. Everybody's more efficient. And those are the kinds of things that we wanted to do. And I know what you said at the top, it's hard for a guy coming in from the outside in, because especially in a close-knit circle, but also the advantage of coming in from the outside, fresh pair of eyes, right? That's why even now I've been here 9 years, you know, we've got an extremely talented leadership team, talented throughout the company, but I still think it's important to bring some fresh views and outside perspectives, whether it's from, you know, new hires, talking to customers, talking to salons, getting out in the field. That was another thing that was big for me. My first project was like, you're leading marketing. So I talked to a lot of the marketers that we had on the team, super smart marketers, classically trained, MBAs, double MBAs. I left high school at 15. I don't have any formal education after that. And I'm not proud of that. It's just, that's what happened for me. But what I do have is a lot of experience, like, in the field, being a hairdresser, working with distributors, understanding the customer, and you can't learn that at school. So one of the things that I suggested to do with the marketing team, you guys need to leave the office, like go see a salon. It's not the way you think or imagine it to be. You know, go find out what's working, what's not working, what the competition's doing. So we did quite a bit of that, and I actually took marketing people on trips with me, and they were excited because they'd never even been on a, you know, some of them never even been out of the state before. So, you know, just doing things like that, I think, brought something different. We had salespeople, they went in the field. Marketing people stayed in the office. Why? Aren't we all on one team? Why can't marketing people and salespeople team up and go out together? And then they'll respect each other when they see how each other's world really is, and bring salespeople in to sit with the marketing people. And we did the same with education. And so, yeah, I think sometimes having a fresh set of eyes, you know, since I've been here, we've had a couple high profile hires from outside. I think I was one of the first in a high level for a long time, but since we've added a few more, And I got to tell you, every time you bring somebody in with outside experience, I grow, I learn, and I'm pretty sure the company's stronger for it.
So you said that you left high school at 15 years old. What gave you the audacity to think that this kid that drops out of school or leaves high school and goes and becomes a hairdresser, cuts hair for a living, makes hair shorter, sweeps it up, works in a salon? What gives you the audacity to become the president of one of the greatest companies in the whole entire world?
Yeah, I agree on that one. Well, honestly, I never planned that far ahead. I just was very focused in the moment that I was in. I finished high school in England. Kids finish school at 16 instead of 18. I've heard some people say it's because we're smarter. I don't think so. I just think they start as younger. I don't know.
You got a better accent. You got a better accent. That's what it is, Jason.
Yeah, it's the accent. But my birthday, hang on, we're going to get some dogs barking.
That's reality, man. That's reality.
That's reality. I'm working from my home office. So, yeah, I got some dogs and somebody came to the door. But, so I left school at 16 and, well, 15. I was still 15 years old. And I was interested in becoming a hairdresser. I'd like to say it's because I had this long-term plan and I was autistic and creative. Honestly, the barber that used to cut my hair, I thought he was a cool dude, and he always had like tons of girls around him. I was like, I don't know what to do. I'm 15. I kind of like girls. This could be a great way for me to like be around lots of beautiful ones, right? So I told my mom that I wanted to work in the local barber shop, and she gave me some great advice. And she said, listen, she said, I like the fact that you want to get a trade. You know, I came from a family working class, none of us ever been to college. You know, it was never even a conversation in my house. Like, what's college? We didn't even know. We all went and got jobs as soon as we finished school. And a lot of, you know, working in factories or tradespeople, that's kind of my family roots. So my mother said to me, hey, if you become a hairdresser, that's a valuable skill. You're always going to be able to put food on the table. She said, but if you're going to be trained, one thing, go to the best salon in town. Like, let's get you the best education that's possible. So she took me to a place called John English, which is where I spent my entire career behind the chair. It was a chain salon in England, much more higher level, definitely an A player, B player, big salons, you know, 60 people working in them, excellent education. They had apprenticeships and they had paid apprenticeships. And then there was a government program at the time called the YTS, which is a youth training scheme. Okay. It was a government-sponsored program to put people who couldn't afford to do apprenticeships basically through an apprenticeship. So I went through on the youth training scheme, and the company that trained me, John English, they didn't pay me anything. The government paid me £17.50 per week, which was... it's like $25, man. It's not much. No, it's 31 years ago, but it's anyway. So yeah, so I walked into John English, had an interview. God, it was just full of like activity and a lot of girls. And I thought, well, this is a great place for a 15-year-old guy to start his career. So I started there and I fell in love with it right away. I mean, it was hard. The apprenticeships in England are long. It's not 9 months, 1500 hours. It's like 2 years of full-time work and then training at the end of the day. So, and getting paid nothing. And you basically, especially the first 6 months, you're a human section clip, you know, just holding sections for people, brushing up, making tea, graduating to shampooing, neutralizing perms. I mean, it was early 90s. Like, all I did all day was neutralize perms, you know, cap highlights, and you know, kind of like, you know. So anyway, it was really tough training, but I realized pretty quick that I was kind of progressing faster than the other people. I just had natural ability in my hands, so that was good. And my career progressed really quickly in that company. I was 15. I finished my training by the time I was just 18. It's long training. And they made me a junior stylist. So I got on the floor. I didn't have any guests. You had to like go out and get your own guests. And pretty quickly I built a book, and pretty quickly I realized I could make more money if I recommended take home. So and I'm super competitive, so I wanted to like be number one with the most services every week and most take home every week. So, you know, just being a top performer in the salon got me elevated much quicker. I mean, you know, you own salons, and they kind of plucked me out of their salons and made me a manager. I think I was a manager by the time I was 20. By the time I was 21, I was doing training for the entire salon. By the time I was in my early 20s, I then went to become like an area trainer and an area manager, where I would have, you know, a clientele in multiple salons, and I just moved around, and that was great. At the same time that was happening, I still wasn't really making any money, but at the same time that was happening, I entered a competition. I only ever entered one competition, hair competition, and I won it. So I have 100% win record. But the competition that I entered, it was with a manufacturer, and it was Young Hairdresser of the Year for the UK. And I won first place overall. You had to be under 25 years of age, and I was 21 when I won. But what was it, why it's relevant is the prize for winning was you got to be on their autistic team. It was another a German manufacturer. I got to be on their autistic team. So I didn't even know what an autistic team was. I'd never been to a trade show. So I got thrust onto stage, and I was a good hairdresser by that point, but I was horrible on stage. I couldn't talk. But yeah, you know, I fumbled through it and kind of started feeling comfortable and kind of liked it. Like traveling, like meeting people, like helping people. And yeah, that's kind of how I got first exposed to the manufacturing side of the industry and not just behind the chair side. And from there, I kind of did that for a while, continued to grow in the salon. At the same time that was happening, so the salons that I was working for, we had 22 locations. Because I was becoming more prominent in that company, the owners took me to a hair show in London. And at that hair show, we saw Farouk Shami. I don't know if you know Farouk Shami, the founder of Farouk Systems, in the corner in a 6x6 booth, screaming and shouting with his red boots, painting people's hair all different colors with his invention, which was pretty progressive in 1991, whenever it was, called Sunglitz. And we got talking to him, and he said, "I'm just launching in the UK. I've launched this product in the US. It's huge. I'm very successful." He wasn't, but he certainly believed he was. And he said, "Tell me about your salon." I said, "We have salons. We have 22 salons." He said, "Would you be interested in taking the product in your salon?" And I said to the owner, "I think this is really cool. It's innovative. It's unique. It's like a 20-minute service. We can, you know, do this as an upgrade and increase our average service ticket." So we decided to take it in our salons. And he also at the same time said, "Well, I don't have any distributors in the UK. Do you want to be my distributor?" So I said, "What's a distributor? I mean, I'm just a kid. I'm still wet behind the ears." And he said, "Well, I want you to like sell it to other salons for me. And you guys have a warehouse, right? You have 22 locations." Okay, we'll be a distributor. We didn't know what we were doing, but so at the same time that I was doing the salon thing, we were basically became a distributor, and I became the salesperson, the marketing person, the education person. So I would go and cold call, knock on salons' door. "Can I give you a demonstration on this product?" I'd do the class. I'd take the order, and boom, that's kind of how we started. So what that did is it taught me, you know, how to, you know, pitch to salons. I didn't even know what marketing was when I was creating it. Like, "Oh, we need flyers. We need, you know," it's a long time ago. "We need something to hand out." So we kind of built this thing as we went along with working in the salon business. And, you know, we built the relationship with Farouk, and Farouk's company really started to grow in the US, and it started to grow in the UK and Europe as well. And then he invited me to be on his autistic team for Europe. So that's really how I built the relationship with Farouk. And that culminated in him asking me to come and be his artistic director and move. And that was a huge decision. I was 26 years old, almost 27 at the time he offered me that. And I just felt like it was one of those little voice moments, like, go for it, man. I'd never even been to America, Cali. I'd never even been. And he said, why don't you come out here, do a show, and tell me what you think. So I came out, I did a show, and I it was, first of all, very different than doing shows in Europe. I mean, in Europe, it's so serious. Now everyone's so serious. Just education. We're not trying to sell products. We're not, you know, waving our arms, no dancing, just doing nice haircuts and explaining what we're doing. That's it. I come to America, and I think Robert was there. Robert's got, like, dancing girls and balloons and, like, huge crowd screaming. I'm like, man, I feel like I'm at a rock concert. But I kind of liked it, but I had a very different approach. That's probably why I didn't last on stage in the U.S., but Farouk said, listen, I'd love to have you over here full time, and a guy like you can do really well here. So, you know, think about it. So I went back and I spoke to the owner of the company that I'd worked with from like 15 years old. And at this point I was nearly 27. And I said, you know, I've been offered this opportunity. I don't want to go there permanently, but is it okay with you if I go out there like four times a year? And I actually got a really kind of surprising response. He said, no. He said, you work for me. He said, stop dreaming about America. He said, you have a great job. You have a good career here. Forget about that. And I didn't like someone telling me at age 26, that was it for me. Like, so it kind of spurred me to make a huge life-changing decision. And I basically said, I quit. I'm going to go back to America. And the guy was really upset. And he said, well, 6 months, you'll be back begging me for your job back. Now he tells everybody how he trained me and I'm this big success story. It's pretty funny how things kind of come around, and I'm cool with him. You know, I wouldn't be where I am without those 12 years there, but so I just came out on a handshake. I came to the US with a suitcase. I think I had like $1,500. I was broke. You know, I sold my house to get much money because I was just rushing to get out here. And I didn't really have a plan. You know, I just, I'm going to come here. I don't know what corporations do. I'm just going to figure it out. You know, I wasn't really scared of anything until I got here. And then when I showed up at the airport, nobody met me. I had to take a taxi to the corporate offices of Farouk. I show up. Nobody knew I was coming. I eventually got to see Farouk and he's like, Oh yeah. I remember I offered you a job. Like, come on. And why don't you sit over here and such will take care of you. I realized pretty quick, no one's going to show me what to do. There's not going to be any onboarding. There's going to be no job description. I just need to figure out how I can make myself a valuable asset to this company. So it's a little bit like when I walked into Paul Mitchell, I just started talking to people, looking for opportunities where I thought I could add value. And I did it and figured it out. And, you know, during my 10 plus years working in Farouk, I learned a lot because I did a lot of different jobs. I started in artistic, did a lot of shows in education, traveled all over the US and world, South America, everywhere, and met cool hairdressers all over the world, met distributors, learned a lot along the way, and did the whole show circuit for a good 5-6 years, like 30, 40 shows a year. I was exhausted and decided I had another one of those moments where they were already using me to train salespeople on product. I was like, well, if I can train people on sales, why can't I lead sales? And I, you know, Farouk was a small company that was growing quick, and Farouk was cool. One thing I loved about him is he's an entrepreneur, and he's like, yeah, hairdressers can do anything because he's a hairdresser. So he put me in charge of sales and marketing, and I had little to no experience in sales and marketing apart from like just street experience. And, yeah, that was a little interesting and tough at first, but, you know, I won people over. I won the customers over. Obviously, I got my job with Paul Mitchell from a recommendation based upon my sales and marketing skills, not my haircutting skills. So, yeah, it was cool. It was really a cool journey. But, you know, I know this is a very long-winded answer to your question, how did I get to where I am? But this is kind of my story. And, you know, it's I often pinch myself. I can't believe it happened. You know, I certainly have worked hard, try and be humble, try and do the right thing, but I would never have guessed, you know, even 9 years ago, if you'd have told me you'd be the president, I wouldn't have said, oh yeah, that's definitely going to happen. I would have said, wow, that's a surprise, you know, so.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you're enjoying it. Now's the time to do some shameless promotion. This episode is brought to you by Squeeze Dried, a delicious, no-hassle way to get superfoods, vitamins, and nutrition. SqueezeDried.com. It's also brought to you by Cardenas Law Group, a high-level boutique law firm for all your personal injury needs. That's CardenasLawGroup.com. Thank you so much again for listening. Hopefully, you're continuing to enjoy the episode. So I think inquiring minds want to know, and when I'm saying that is just my mind, you're one of the most responsible dudes that I've ever met too. I mean, even from a very early age. I mean, when I first met you, we're right around the same age. You're 8 months older, which is way older than me. We talked about that earlier, but I've always seen this maturity, you always laid back. You were asking questions, you know, you were very wise. And what I want to know, though, Jason, is what was the dumbest thing you bought when you started making real money? Like, what was that thing that was like, bang, I don't need it, but I'm just going to get it. Here it is. What would you do?
A Maserati.
Now, was this immediately? Was this like, get the position and then I'm going to get the Maserati?
No, I'm pretty conservative, believe it or not.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But one of the things I did, I just bought this Maserati. No, this is like, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago.
Okay.
I bought it. And the minute I drove it off the lot, I was like, this is not me. What am I doing? Like, this is totally just what you just said. That's not me. I don't even like cars, you know? Like, of course, I want to drive a nice car, but I'm one of those guys, if someone says, oh, man, nice ride, what engine's in that? I don't know. I have no clue. And that's okay, but so why would I buy, like, a flashy Maserati that, you know, as soon as you press the accelerator, everyone's like, oh, wow, look at that car. Like, I was just like, I don't want people to look at me, you know?
Mm-hmm. What was the thing too? Because obviously, coming from a working class family, I think all of us, when things start to happen, things start to roll. Like, the first person we think about is our mom, right? And we think about all the hard work that they do, all the things that they did. What was that thing? I'll tell you what I did, and this wasn't a big one, but I remember I was doing a show in Kansas, and the whole weekend we were saying, "You ain't in Kansas anymore," like the whole nine. My mom was a huge fan of The Wizard of Oz and never told this story to anybody. But in the airport, there was everything Wizard of Oz. And she was a music box person. She loved little music boxes, little trinkets. And there was this music box that had The Wizard of Oz. And her and my pop were struggling financially at the time. And she needed a certain amount of money. And I can't remember the exact amount. I think it was maybe $1,000 or $1,500. I bought the music box, and then I took 15 $100 bills and I put it inside and I wrapped it up and I sent it to her. And she it. And my mom was so excited about the box. And she opened it up and she was like, yeah, whatever. And then, but she was like, she held that box the day that she died 3 years ago. She had that box with her in her room that whole time. What was the thing that you did for your mama when Jason started, like, you know, when it started to rain?
Yeah. So I'd say one of the earliest things I did, I think, which they did not want me to do, but I just did it. My dad was not well enough to be working, but needed to work. Like, my dad had a lot of heart issues, had a heart attack in his 40s. He's like 78 now. He was still working into his mid-60s because they still needed to pay the mortgage. They didn't have the means. They didn't have any savings. They didn't have any retirement. They didn't have the means for my dad to start working. And he wasn't well. So I called my mom and worked out with her how we could pay the mortgage off so my dad could retire. And my mom was, like, so happy about that. And again, it really – it wasn't a lot of money. It's, but for them, it could have been like $100 million because they just had no means of getting the money to pay off. But, you know, it wasn't such a big deal for me. And it, me doing that, I think, first of all, they really didn't want me to. But it was, you know, I'm glad that I did that because it allowed my dad to retire. And I think that's why he's still alive today. You know, I honestly think if my dad had kept going, he was, because he worked in manual labor and he was ill and in his 60s and he'd already had a heart attack and a bypass. And he just needed to be chilling out, man. And he was worrying about working and providing still and shouldn't have been at his age. Yeah.
Jason, tell us one more stupid thing that you bought when you got money. I know that the Maserati, I mean, but some people are like, well, you need a car. But I'm talking about something that you do not need that is so dumb that, okay, and I'm going to tell you another one.
Okay.
I bought the largest on the market, Bluetooth, boombox, and loudest one on the market. Jason, when I tell you this thing is big, it is like my wingspan almost, and it's covered in the Snoop Dogg album, and it's barely carryable. But I bought it because I got a free one too. So I bought one, and I got one for free. And that's when I realized that I should not, that's why God made me broke when I was a kid, because if I would have got what I wanted when I was a kid, I would have had the dumbest things in the world. Tell us something super irresponsible that you have done.
Golly, I sound so boring. I can't really think of any. I have a couple things that I bought that I was like, that was stupid. Okay. One was the Maserati.
Okay.
Two was, I'd always wanted a Tom Ford suit, right? I always wanted one. I like nice clothes. Cars, I couldn't care less, but I like nice clothes, right? Especially, you know, you and I were on stage a lot. I'm going to look good. So I graduated up to, like, expensive suits, but I was always, like, looking. I want to go that ultra-premium luxury, like, nice experience. Like, go to Tom Ford, get fitted, have a gorgeous suit. Man, I was so disappointed. I bought this suit. It was more than double of the most expensive suit that I've ever bought. And I bought some expensive suits. And I just, as soon as I bought it, I was like, I don't even like this suit. It doesn't fit well. I'm so disappointed. And I remember, like, just recently, like, what did I do? That was such a waste of money. I was like, so stupid. But yeah, that's about the dumbest thing. Doesn't compare with your big ghetto blast or whatever it was.
It's called a bump box, man. I just want to let you know it's a bump box. And my wife got home. I had ordered it while she was gone. She got home and she's like, what is in the living room? I was like, you don't understand, girl. I got one for free. And she's like, for free? How much you pay for the other one? I said, that does not matter. It's all about the fact that I got the free one. I got the free one. I was good. Jason, tell us the misconception for the listeners out there. A lot of times they think and they see you, and I love hearing your story because, you know, it starts, you start at 15 years old, right? At 15 years old, getting out of school, you said you're smarter than Americans. I understand that. You already said that. That was on, you know, we'll release that and soundbite it. But you start in that realm, you work your way through, and you just see these little opportunities, these little windows. You keep going, you keep going, you keep going. Most people see Jason Yates now. You're the president of Paul Mitchell, the number one privately held company in the professional beauty industry. And most people don't know that. They think it's a publicly traded company. It's not. It's owned by a guy, like a couple guys. Yeah. Now, a lot of people, when they think of Jason, the president of that company, man, everything's cool for him. His life. Tell us some of the misconceptions about being the president of one of the greatest companies in the world.
Oh, the buck stops with me. That's for sure. So, yeah, is it cool? Is it an honor? Absolutely. But it's a tremendous amount of responsibility, you know. And, you know, as I said earlier, I'm competitive. You know, I want to be the best president ever. I want JPMS to be number one in every area. And I put a tremendous amount of pressure on myself. And, you know, I want to paint a hard story. Like, it's a cool job. It's a great job. If I'm going to be president of any beauty company in the world, I want to be president of this company because of how cool JP and Angus are. You know, they're the kind of people that aren't emotional. They're very calm. They trust people to do a good job. They don't micromanage. They leave you alone. So that's super cool. But yeah, I mean, listen, I have the responsibility of running the largest company in the professional beauty industry, and yeah, that'll keep you up at night some nights, you know, for sure. But it comes with the territory, and I love it, you know, and I fully accept the responsibility.
So every single person in the company that I've been around, and my journey has been 29 years, and seeing it now, for those of you out there, I'm not an employee of Paul Mitchell, but I've been with the company for that amount of time, and I've been around. Every single person has a personal, like, heartfelt, like, story with Angus and JP. Okay, now I could tell you one with myself. With JP, my dad got diagnosed with prostate cancer. We were on a motorcycle ride. JP pulls me aside and says, "Hey, just wanted to let you know, I want to make sure that your dad is okay. I've got a couple things that I want him to get in touch with." He tells me about it, and then he says, "Remind me tomorrow." And I was like, he's a busy guy, ain't trying to be in his face. He came to me the next day and said, "Hey, Kelly, let's get that thing taken care of." He gets on his phone, which is a flip phone at the time. You know what I'm talking about. He pulls out his flip phone. He calls his wife and says, "Eloise, can you bring that stuff down?" Has his wife drive it down. When she gets to the place, he clears everyone because everyone's clamoring for him. And you know how that is with JP. Everyone's clamoring for him. He pushes everyone away from the table, grabs me and my dad, and sits down and reads the instructions on the box that my dad could have read. And make sure, looks him in the eye the whole time. Nobody else in the room exists. And tells my dad, "This is how you're going to use it. This is what you're going to do. And if you need anything, I want you to get a hold of me and make sure that everything is okay." And then after that, everyone was clamoring for pictures. He grabbed my dad again and he sat him down again, pushed everyone away from the table and said, "Are you okay? Do you understand what you need to do? And if you need anything, you let me know."
Wow.
Tell me something, or tell our listeners something. And I have these stories with Angus also.
Yeah.
But these are stories that are common in this culture, but not common in the world. Jason, can you share one with us?
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail right on the head, especially with John Paul. I mean, John Paul, no matter who he meets, he always makes those people feel more important than he is in the room, which is incredible when you think about who the guy is. He always immediately asks you, "Are you okay? Are you happy? What can I do for you?" I mean, I see him do it with everybody. Everybody in the company, any customer, his first question is not, "What are you doing for me?" Even though we all work for him. It's, "What can I do for you?" And that's not just something he's practiced and he does. That's just him being genuinely concerned about other human beings. And I think his whole success is based upon that, you know. I really do. As far as what has he done for me, but wow, so much. What hasn't he done for me? I'll tell you one that was funny. When we first met, and I just started at the company, and we were still trying to figure out how we were going to make it work moving to LA. I was still staying in. Actually, I think I just got an apartment, and my wife was in Texas, and I was here, and my wife was out visiting, and my wife was concerned because she was trying to get transferred from Dallas to LA as a flight attendant. And John Paul's, I got a pretty attractive wife. And John Paul said, I want to talk to Julie, see how she's doing. And you step out a minute, Jason. And I didn't know John Paul that well. I was like, "Wow, is he making a move on my wife? Like, I got no chance. But anyway, what John Paul did is he asked my wife which airline she worked for, and she worked for United Airlines, and he got somebody on the phone and he said, "I want you to buy $100,000 stock in United Airlines." And Julie's like, What are you doing? And Julie's my wife. And JP said, "I'm a shareholder at United now. They have to listen to me, and I want you moved to LAX." Seriously. So Julie told me, I burst back in and I said, "JP, that's not going to help." And he goes, "Oh, I'm a shareholder now." I said, "Don't do it, don't do it." But you know, it's just the kind of guy he is. Like, so, and that was like, I think I'd been on the job a week, and he was deadly serious. Like, buy $100,000 of United stock so that we can make sure Jason's wife gets transferred to LA.
I think you said something very important, that your wife is very beautiful, which she is, and you married you married up, which is the smartest thing you could do, because you stay grateful. Do me a favor, give me 30 seconds of you looking into the camera as if you're talking to your wife and telling her stuff that she doesn't hear enough.
Oh wow, that's putting me on the spot. But yeah, I think I tell my wife every day how much I love her. You know, we met on a plane, and the first time I saw her, you know, I had that voice again, right? You know, it's like, oh, you got to get to know this lady. And it wasn't easy to get to know her, but that feeling that I had then, I still feel now all the time. And I definitely married up. I married someone that's not only beautiful, but she's my best friend. And, you know, I just feel great being with her each and every day. And I actually, when I'm not working, I spend all my time with her. And also, what I'd like to tell her is, since she came into my life, it, like, that's when my life just kind of completed. You know, it's like I met my wife, and then we got married. And as soon as we got married, boom, Paul Mitchell. And my career went from being good to great. And my life went from being good to great. Yeah.
So you're saying if you marry the right woman, you'll become the president of Paul Mitchell? So that's the way to get it? Because, I mean, I'm maybe. All right, cool, because I married the right woman, so I'm waiting on that call now. I'm in. The call.
The good news is you're so much younger than me, so when I retire, it's yours, baby.
That's what I'm talking about, man. That works out perfect. Do me a favor. Give me a two-minute NBA on the difference between marketing and sales, because so many people think marketing and sales work together. And for those of us who know and understand, they're so much different, but give us a two-minute NBA on this for our listeners.
Wow. A two-minute NBA.
Let's go. That, I mean, what I want our listeners to understand, and if we could pack that into that 2 minutes of saying, like, here's what marketing is, bang. Here's what sales is, bang. They're not the same. There are good marketers out there that can't sell worth a lick, and there are really good salespeople that don't know how to take their stuff to market.
Right.
But help us, because, I mean, obviously, you're a lot smarter than all us American people. That's what you said. You know, I'm just joking with you, Jason. There, people are going to soundbite that part, too. You know that, right?
Yeah, and I don't think I actually said that.
I know, but we're going back to the tape, man. We're going back to it. Yeah. So, two-minute MBA, give it to us.
Boy, that's a tough one, Kelly, for me to kind of summarize it, because I'm not a textbook kind of guy, and I'm not. You know, I didn't learn classically and learn like, oh, this is what marketing is. I can tell you what it is to me. And, you know, to me, marketing is really understanding what somebody's needs are. You know, it's understanding what somebody wants and then just simply providing them a solution to what that need is. And, you know, I think so many marketers don't really know what their customer wants. So they get too caught up in reading trend reports and studying what others are doing. And I think personally, that's the beginning of the end when you spend all your time looking at what everybody else is doing, because it's important to know, but just as a reference, that shouldn't be the guiding force that drives you. So for me, marketing is understanding my customer, is trying to find out how I can make their life easier, how I can make their day better, and then providing a solution to it. So, and to me, sales is not pitching the product. It's kind of similar, because to sell something, if you're just trying to push something and sell something, to me, that's never been my style. It's always been, again, like looking at, well, what do they actually need? You know, what do I have that I can sell? What do they actually need? And what do I have from what they need that I can share with them? you know? So, you know, that's my uneducated explanation of sales and marketing that's based purely on experience and lots of it.
But I think that's the best education, man. I mean, when you said that you don't come from a formal education, most formal education came from somebody getting their butt kicked and then telling the story about it. You know what I mean? And that's why I believe that the company is in such great hands with you, because you're not coming from just a, hey, I read this, I need to do this. You're saying like, I'm out there trying this thing and it's working out. Tell me how important culture is to the bottom line, because what you talked about earlier and what you've talked about this whole time, Jason, is the culture of not only the culture of Jason, right? Like you talked about the culture of Paul Mitchell, you talked about the culture of Farouk, but there was the culture of Jason that you were raised in. How important is that culture to the bottom line?
I think it's vitally important to the bottom line. And you know, what I love about John, Paul and Angus is they understand that a company's most precious resource is not its products. It's not its processes. It's its people and how we treat them. And you can look at it a few different ways. If you purely look at it from a spreadsheet with no emotion, you'll make one set of decisions, which potentially can help the bottom line. But the reality is people that make those decisions, they might make some short-term savings, but long-term they kill the culture, which kills the work ethic, which kills the magic, which kills the top line, which leads to the bottom line. So do you have to make tough decisions sometimes that can hurt people? Yeah, you do. That's business. But it's how you do it. Do you do it with respect? Do you do it with honor? And you know what? I believe we do. And I believe as a result of it, it positively impacts the success of the company on the bottom line.
So, Jason, I started the podcast because of my kids, Maddox and McKenna, who you've met many times. Yeah. Maddox is 9 now. Little gangster. Wow. He is on his own level. You should see him. He's got 4 dreads in the back, got one side of his head shaved. The other, I mean, he's his own character. You got McKenna, who's 12, and she has the heart and soul of, I mean, she loves everybody, everything, and it just permeates from her. She's the artist in our family. I made the podcast for them because I wanted to take iconic people like yourself, the president of the greatest company, I believe, in the not only professional beauty industry, but in the world. Okay. An iconic person like yourself that's the president of something like that, and I want to show them that you're not a superhero, that you don't have different things running through your veins, that you're simply a person with a great attitude, phenomenal work ethic, and that you're willing to do the right things for the right reasons, and that's why the right things keep happening. What advice would you give to Maddox and McKenna? And if you could use their names, Jason, and look into the camera, it would be awesome.
Sure. So Maddox and McKenna, I mean, first of all, you should be very proud. You have a wonderful mother and a wonderful father that set great examples for you on how to live your best life. My advice to you is, continue to be yourself, but, always be honest. I think that's an important quality as you move through life. Honesty, accountability, be humble, always follow up and keep your word. I think that's, we only have our word, and I think those things, if you're looking for the secrets to success, it's not some complicated magic formula, or I just think it's doing those things and having the discipline to do them each and every day. And if you do, you're going to have one heck of a successful, happy, fulfilled life, whatever that means to you.
Well, Jason, it has been an absolute pleasure. I want to tell you how much I appreciate, and every single listener out there, I want to let you know this is not a paid sponsorship by me. Like this is a situation that I'm an evangelist of this brand because of what I've gone through in the last 29 years, how it's impacted my family, how it's my dad has been able to use the principles in power plant construction, my mom in the medical industry, my brother in the law industry, my other brother in the medical industry. Every one of the concepts and principles that we have, that I have learned in the Paul Mitchell culture has helped every single person that is in my life connected. So it's not because I'm paid to say that. It's because I feel that from my heart, and that can't be replaced. But you understand, guys, anyone out there listening that listen to this, why we're in such good hands and why the company is doing so well. And it's, he's going to deflect and say, it's not just because of me. And I know it's not just because of one individual, but I tell you, as the president of that company, John Paul Mitchell Systems is in great, great hands. And it's amazing to be able to spend some time with you, Jason. So now's the time. If you're listening out there, click the link, subscribe, do all the things that you know you need to do. And what I'm going to ask for you to do is, if you got any value, which I know every one of you did, I want you to share this with every single person possible. Because if a 15-year-old kid that didn't go to college can become the president of the greatest company in the professional beauty industry, what could you do if you had the right attitude and you look for the right opportunities? Jason, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, my man.
Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate it.